We are talking today with Heather Chaplin and Aaron Ruby. They are co-authors of the new book, Smart Bomb, The Quest for Art, Entertainment, and Big Bucks in the Video Game Revolution. Heather and Aaron, thank you for spending time with us today.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
If we could begin, start out and tell us, what was the motivation in writing your book, Smart Bomb?
It's actually sort of funny. I came home one day and Aaron was installing a PlayStation 2, which at the time filled me with utter horror. This was in the spring of 2001. And the real question in my mind was, how could somebody as intelligent and adult as my husband like video games? And we both started looking into it and soon realized it was a really, really rich subject that really had not gotten the kind of coverage it needed to get.
And Aaron, what was your motivation in plugging in that video game?
Well, what happened was I'd been out in New Jersey going to school at Rutgers, getting my PhD in philosophy, and all my friends at school, we'd just hang out in our offices and play a lot of Quake over the T1 lines. So that kind of brought me back to gaming. I was a big gamer when I was a kid, and we realized that we were both on opposite ends of the spectrum culturally. I was totally cool with games, and my wife was completely
I was literally like questioned my marriage when I came home and found him playing games. I mean, it really went through me, like, what kind of adult plays video games, you know, what kind of intelligent person. But then he was telling me about all these guys at this program where you have to be like a rocket scientist to get into it, and they spent most of their free times playing video games. And, you know, this was also 2001, and things have changed a lot since then. We've grown in just those 4 years to a much, much higher level of acceptance of the medium. So you also have to remember, in 2001, it was still something guys were kind of keeping to themselves. The Xbox hadn't come out yet. So we really thought that we'd make a great team, because Aaron sort of has, I like to say, like, you know, has this sort of heart of the gamer. He really gets what the games mean to people and was, like, you know, the initial guide. And I feel like what I could bring to the project was a pair of outside eyes, which sometimes is a really helpful thing as a reporter, and that together we could somehow kind of tell the whole story that no one had quite yet done before.
And plus the other motivation was that we got to keep the PlayStation 2.
That's true.
Talk a bit about, give us kind of an overview, if you could, of the industry, where we are today, because I can remember some of the basic games which were played, let's say, on a large mainframe, or, you know, I think most people remember, let's say, Pong, things have come an incredible distance since Pong.
Right now, the video game industry, it surpasses box office sales. It's about a $10 billion a year industry. But the thing that we really like to do is not get too caught up in the numbers. You know, as reporters, we're sort of skeptical of industry numbers by default. And we really feel like the thing to pay attention to is how deeply, deeply penetrated into the culture the games have come in a relatively short time. And I think what's relevant particularly about, and we were so glad to get to profile in the book about Microsoft coming into the industry, was that both Microsoft and Sony, you know, were huge corporations that did not have background in gaming. And the very fact that they decided to come into it sort of says, okay, this isn't going away anytime soon. This is a real medium, and very major companies, for a lot of motivation, want to get into the space and take advantage of the fact that we really are becoming a nation of gamers.
Yeah, one way to think about the last generation, which launched in the 2000-2001 window, where you have the Xbox, the PlayStation 2, and the Nintendo GameCube. When we first started talking to people at Microsoft for the last generation, the first Xbox, their comment was always, look, we're not trying to hit the mainstream now. We're trying to first establish a credible presence with gamers. And the big difference between that generation and the one that's just coming up right now with the Xbox 360 is that now you see Microsoft is ready to make their move. This is the generation they want to start bleeding outside of the traditional gamer consumer and into the mainstream market in general.
You see them on MTV now instead of doing more, you know, subcultural kind of advertising. They're really going after the MTV market now. They are determined to move it into the mainstream, which is interesting because it actually irritates some gamers and some game developers who feel like, hey, what about us? We're the real heart of this industry, and now you're kind of running after this idea that gaming is suddenly cool, which is sort of interesting.
Talk about the bigger impacts that the games and this industry are having on culture itself, because I think there's a significant number of people that are listening, probably that have never actually even played any of these games,
sure,
are probably repelled by them.
Sure. Well, one thing that Aaron really started thinking about early on is that the video games are genuinely a different medium. And anytime a new medium enters the cultural fabric, you're going to have repercussions in the society. One of the sayings that really inspired us early on is from anthropology, and it says, "Show me the games of your children, and I'll show you the next 100 years." So we really felt like this was an important subject to look at, because if people starting in Generation X grew up with, you know, the Atari system and then arcade culture, and if younger kids have grown up with Nintendo, they're going to keep playing games. Well, what is this new medium, and what effects is it going to have on us? Just like the novel had new effects, just like the moving image had new effects. And Aaron, you should explain just how different of a medium it is.
Yeah, well, one way to think about the difference between traditional media like print and film and video games, and the reason why we say that rather than just being a new media cousin to these traditional forms, they're actually a new species of medium altogether, is that when you communicate or convey information in traditional media, it's done through description, either, you know, a string of words, a stream of images. But video games, by and large, share one thing in common, and that is that they're all models. Traditional media is like getting directions. You want to go somewhere, someone writes down directions for you. Using a model is more like using a map. Another way to think about it is if you wanted to learn about the solar system, about the relative motions of the planets, one way to do it would be just to go to a book and look up their orbits, or you could maybe look at some satellite imagery. But another thing you could do is to use what's called an orrery, which is basically just a fancy word for those models of the solar system that you saw when you were in your middle school science fair with the styrofoam balls. And it's basically like one of those, and it rotates, keeping the planets in their proper respective relative positions. And by playing with this model of the solar system, you would learn things about the solar system implicitly that you would learn explicitly from a more descriptive form of entertainment, let's say film strip or whatnot. And the point of all this is just to say that it changes the kind of cognitive skills that are required to engage with the medium. For example, and when you're using a model as a means of communication, particularly with video games, three-dimensional visualization, spatial relations, analytic skills, exploring the connections between cause and effect, how one's a small event in one part of a system can have large consequences in another part of a system. And as Will Wright put it in the book, really, traditional media take you on a single trajectory through the space of possibilities for that world that you're currently engaged in. Let's say Lord of the Rings, you know, the quest to destroy the ring. Whereas video games allow you to explore this entire space of possibility. And I think that's a real difference that a lot of people don't appreciate, and it really has a big effect on how people engage with the media. It really is a whole new frontier, and that's one of the exciting things. Granted, with that come a lot of concerns.
I mean, that was one of the things that really struck us right away is, you know, you think, you know, it's couched in the sort of corporate entertainment term, so you just think, oh, it's fun and games. But you realize this is an incredibly powerful new technology and a new medium that's come out. And there's just no way that it's not going to affect the entire next generation. When you have kids raised on something that are fostering certain skill sets as opposed to other skill sets, again, back to that anthropological saying, it gives you a little bit of a glimpse into what sort of citizens we're creating for the future. And I think on sort of a deeper level, that's what really interested us in spending 4 years immersed in the industry learning about this stuff.
And in some respect, that's why it's kind of, it's a little bit shocking that as a culture, we've been in such a state of denial over video games that we've missed a lot of opportunities that, for example, the military hasn't. The military was probably the first sector of our culture that really understood what video games were, what was so powerful about them, and how they could be harnessed to accomplish non-entertainment goals. And, you know, education and the social sciences and the business community, they're starting to wake up. But it really, for quite a while, it was pretty much just the military who was there and kind of came in and understood how they could exploit some of this technology.
Well, talk about that some more, if you would. My understanding is one of the most popular games right now was financed indirectly through our taxes is America's Army.
That's correct. It's had, what, how many? 6 million downloads? Is that right? Making it very, very popular. America's Army was the brainchild of a guy we profile in the book named Colonel Casey Wardinsky. And it was based on his epiphany that there was no positive imagery or explanation about life in the Army and pop culture. And he realized that video games was the way to do it. So he formed a joint venture with some guys at the Naval Postgraduate School up in Monterey, a guy named Mike Zaida, who's also in the book. And they realized they had to create a first-person shooter. Do you think people know what that means?
If you could explain that.
Yeah, first-person shooter, like those games Doom and Quake, they're where your view is down the eye of a barrel of a shotgun or some other very powerful firearm, and it's, you know, basically the sort of kill or be killed games. So they knew they wanted to take that model, and they had to make a really, really good one and use it for recruitment purposes. So it was something that you could download for free from the website or that they would send a disc to you, and it's become wildly, wildly popular. Sorry, jumping.
No, I was just going to say, the idea was to create basically a simulation of what it would be like in the culture of the Army, what
right.
it would be like if you were to join the Army. Beyond just the first-person shooter element, it was designed to be a complete package that was supposed to help potential recruits understand what they were getting themselves into and in a way that was hopefully for the military engaging.
And it's interesting because, you know, that's an example of the Army using, you know, sort of sneaking into the pop culture through a video game. There also are examples of games being made specifically for training purposes. And I want to go back to the point Aaron just made that I think is really important, where he said that the game is an attempt to show what it's like in the military. Because we have an entire chapter that is about first-person shooter culture and the professional competition that's arisen from it. And at first, you just look at the content, and all you sort of see is the violence and the gore. But then when you really talk to people, people who have done research for the military, people who've studied it as a medium, what you learn is that these games don't make you any more likely to go on a homicidal rage. They don't seem to have any correlation between the desire to kill when you play these games. But what they do seem to teach, and people will say this jokingly to you, this in the industry, and the colonels who, you know, are getting into this will say it, is they teach you to basically like life in the Army. They're teaching you serious squad-based tactical maneuvers, how to set up a kill zone. One great example that people don't know, and I always find, and Aaron too, I think, very ironic, is the game Doom, which has probably been one of the most
vilified
games of all time. It was the game the kids at Columbine, you know, were into. It sort of almost helped invent this first-person shooter paradigm of a game. The Marines in what? Was it the mid-90s, I guess? Mm-hmm. The Marines actually took a copy of the game and they modified the art so that instead of being sort of this dungeon of hell, they overlaid floor plans for a U.S. embassy and trained soldiers how to get hostages out. So again, it also, I think, kind of goes back to what Aaron was saying about why it's so important to understand that this is a new form of medium, because it's not so much about the content as about the actual mechanics of the game and the fact that you're interacting with this model and getting to have these experimental experiences that really are fostering sort of whatever skill sets we choose.
And one of the interesting things about that game, and actually had been introduced into first-person shooters a few years back, was the idea of, instead of just playing yourself against the computer, where the computer simulates everything, now they have this area where many people can log on via the internet, and you're actually playing against both the computer as well as, I don't know, hundreds of other people.
Well, with first-person shooters, typically, they're constantly pushing the limits. I think now it's getting up to around the 32-64 range, which is, for that type of game, which tends to be the most taxing on a computer system, and coordinating that over a network can get to be pretty crazy. But yes, absolutely. When you go to the, for example, Heather mentioned the professional gaming competitions that are based off of first-person shooters. It's really all about being able to work as a team. The the premier quality that all the players, the really good players, talk about seeking in teammates is not really about Twitch skills. It's not sure, being a great shooter is an important skill, but they all talk about they want people who are smart.
It was uncanny. I'm sorry to interrupt, but that word smart just came up again and again as the ultimate compliment.
And by smart, they typically mean they want people who are analytical, who can think quickly, and who can process large amounts of information and prioritize that information rapidly, which also is an adequate description of this kinds of skills that many people in the military are trying to foster when they use video games as a training tool.
In fact, in one of our conversations with Colonel Wardinsky, we asked him what basically ultimately a video game did. If games, you know, foster skills in people, what were these fostering? And we were really fascinated by what his answer was, which was the ability to make quick choices amidst a sea of information. And I thought, well, that's a pretty good description for modern life and certainly for modern warfare.
Now, have you run across information, evidence in working on your book that the Army is then somehow finding the people that do well at this game and encouraging them to join the Army?
It's interesting you ask that question. Early on, when some of these projects were getting off the ground, there was discussion about whether, for example, a game like America's Army, they have the technology, and it was a fairly, well, it wasn't trivial, but it was a fairly simple thing to accomplish, to track stats of players and then issue recruitment letters based on that. But that was dropped fairly early on. The military is very sensitive in this arena, at least. They seem very sensitive to worries about the connection between children, entertainment, and the military.
Yeah. It's funny because the same project was codenamed The Last Starfighter after, do you know that movie from the 80s, I think, where that kid is such a good, he's like the best at his arcade game, and it turns out the machines were put there by aliens looking to recruit, you know, the best starfighters. And that was literally what they codenamed their game, unironically. But they did decide, as Aaron said, not to pass the info on to the military.
Right.
Not to collect it.
Yeah.
It also reminds me of a book that you actually do talk about in your book, which I'd read years ago, called Ender's Game.
Oh,
exactly.
Yeah.
Which, again, was, you know, young kids who are secretly brought into video games, and it turns out they think they're playing a video game, but it turns out to be reality that they're dealing with. And we're kind of looking at, even if there appears to be no evidence that the military is doing this recruiting, I mean, would you say it's a fair assumption that based on the hardware we have available to us, that it's not that much of a jump to, with things like drone planes and stuff, that people could perhaps in the not-so-distant future interconnect some of these video game consoles to real-life equipment out in the field?
I think the answer is that, yes, particularly in the military's case, they're going to emphatically be connected. They're already working on ways to do that. Here's a kind of a rudimentary example. You have a battlefield, and each of your soldiers has a PC embedded in their gear, and they have some kind of PDA device that they use to interface it with it. Excuse me. Meanwhile, there is a real-time, three-dimensional version of the battlefield that can be accessed by any soldier in the world, can log on and see what's going on, how the troops are moving, what tactics are being used, and the idea is, well, I'll pass to you.
I mean, one thing that one of the characters in the book who's really involved in this, Michael Macedonia, talked about is how one day soldiers, even who aren't in active warfare, can still be part of the game. They can be keeping track of what's going on their 3D world virtual simulation on their PDA. And I just have to add, I know when we're talking, it sounds like science fiction, and it's not, which is one of the things that really struck me, is all of this technology is real. I mean, there's a big document from the Army a couple of years ago called Transformation, which is about the need to, you know, switch from these, you know, the wars of the past to these sort of asymmetrical ongoing conflicts of the future. And along with that, they have something called the Future Objective Force Warrior, which is a fancy name for the soldier of the future. And at a conference a couple of years ago, a military conference that we went to, we got to see him. And one thing I noticed was the guy who was explaining about him kept saying he's a platform on legs, he's a platform on legs, because as Aaron was saying, he has, you know, a Pentium class computer on him embedded in his lightweight, you know, chemical retarding fabric. He's got a PDA device on his wrist that allows him to keep track and get information in real time about whatever movement is going on in other places. He's got a device over his eye that sets up targets over targets. You know, it's basically, you know, it's as if being at war is becoming closer and closer to being in a video game. Of course, not the reality, and I think that's one of the reasons, it's, you know, Ender's Game is disturbing, to find out that that's a big influence and inspiration on these people, because, and I'm just talking personally here, you know, I would say that the real point of that book is that you were making unknowing killers out of children, and that's a pretty major thing to do to a person. But the way these guys see it is, you know, this is a generation of kids who are raised on video games. If we build controllers, I mean, you see all the time at their expos that they are intentionally building the controllers of unmanned devices to play like a Nintendo, you know, station with the joystick and whatnot. I mean, we really felt, and in fact, you'll notice we sort of wrote the chapter almost as if it was science fiction. It really started to feel so, so weird at a point.
Yeah, one interesting thing about how Ender's Game kind of fits into this, as you mentioned, is that Ender's Game is one of these books that a lot of people who read it are extraordinarily disturbed by it and feel it's this, you know, let's take this as a cautionary tale. Similarly, a lot of other people who've read the book, you know, their response is along the lines of, wow, it's absolutely stunning what children can do if they're trained early and if they're put in an environment where they're fully engaged. So the same book gets two dramatically different readings, and we find typically that's a good analogy for the way that this kind of technology is being perceived by the military
point.
And by the general culture when they find out about it. I mean, some people's reaction are very along the lines of Heather, where to them it can be really rather disturbing. The flip side of it is, and I think what a lot of people in the military would argue, is that by amplifying this technology, and really the key tool that you have on the battlefield is information. You know, once you get past the hardware, if you have the right information, you know how to deploy that hardware and the power.
So it seems that, to go along with what you were just saying, it seems that this industry also tends to focus primarily, its largest audience appears to be younger people. Would that be a fair statement?
Well, the average age of a gamer, according to stats now, is about 30. But again, bringing that healthy skepticism to all stats, you know, that includes my friend's mother, who would be horrified at the idea that she's a video game player, but she plays solitaire on her computer for an hour or two a day. So, yes, those numbers are real, but I think when you're still talking about the hardcore gamers, the people playing, you know, over 20 hours a week, it's probably skews younger and skews more male. There's been a lot of attention lately because the number of women who play games has been rising. For example, in The Sims, and we profile the creator of that, an absolutely fascinating guy named Will Wright, that has almost a 50% level of female gamers in that game. And I personally believe that it's really interesting when you talk to younger people. We're in our 30s, but when you talk to, you know, sort of people under 20, teenagers and kids, they all play games. It's not a boy-girl thing. It would be like someone coming to someone of our generation when we were teenagers and saying, do you watch TV? You know, we would have looked at them like they're crazy, and we soon realized asking them, do you play games, is the wrong question. The right question is, what games do you play? They all play games. And I suspect that as they get older, and this will happen somewhat organically and somewhat because of the, you know, monetary interests involved, they will continue to play games as they get older. It's, they have the same love of it that, you know, you might have for film, because you have these wonderful memories of going to the movies as a kid and, you know, really related to it. There are people who grew up in Nintendo, and that's the universe and the paradigm they feel comfortable with, and they're going to move on to adult fare as they get older, I think, whether they're male or female.
Have you run across any evidence that shows if there's any negative effects from playing these games? Are people actually significantly influenced by the content of the games?
Yeah, that's actually a huge question. It's actually, I would say overall that it's, in many ways, it's really still quite open-ended. There's reasonable evidence that shows that when you play particularly a video game with violent content, depending on how that's defined, in the short term, after playing, there's significant evidence to suggest that the player has a heightened sense of aggressiveness, probably due to kind of a role-playing effect. If you're asked to take on the demeanor and the tasks of someone who is just a merciless killing machine, then I guess to some extent it's reflected by this aggressiveness. But that's very short-term. There are really no good long-term studies in terms of either effect on aggressiveness, propensity to commit aggressive acts. Similarly, a lot of the, as I'm sure you're aware, a lot of states are now considering or have passed legislation prohibiting the sale of violent games with violent content to minors. And one of the big claims that gets put into this legislation is that that playing with violent video games has a neurological effect that can retard the areas of the frontal lobe that are responsible for socialization and things like that. But it turns out those claims are based on two studies out of Japan that were never actually peer-reviewed. So I think the bottom line is that because the medium is young and because people who actually understand the medium are just now in the last 5 to 10 years of the age where they're becoming researchers and concerned citizens and are maturing, that we're getting to the point where we can start building the kind of quality research we need to really understand this, to know to what extent we should take the Ender's Game as a cautionary tale, and to what extent, for example, can we train first responders using video game technology or medical students who are already using video game technology. There's no doubt that using video game technology is among the most, if not the most, powerful tools for education.
Yeah.
It's a question of how are we going to capitalize on this?
Yeah, and I often find myself thinking at the end of the day, you know, it's a technology like any other. What it gets used for depends on us as people. So if we choose to, you know, leave it in the hands of the military and corporate entertainment, that's where it will be. But like something that was very heartening to me was going to the Serious Game Summit this week, which is a new movement. And it's funny that Ender's Game keeps coming up because there was a scientist and an educator from the National Academy who had a seminar called Building the Ultimate Ender's Game, but what she was talking about was the woeful lack of good science and engineering education in this country and the power of video games to really engage the player, which any educator will tell you is what truly makes people learn, is when they have an emotional response, when they feel engaged, when they're enjoying themselves. And so I think we are starting to see, you know, for example, like educators really realize that this is something that could be used actually to teach things other than, you know, how to form killing zones. And I do also just want to say, I feel like we've gone such a dark route this conversation, that there really are, one of the things that struck me as someone who hadn't been a gamer is there are wonderful games out there. It's like just like movies, like there are games you would die if your kid didn't get a chance to play. You know, there are games that are so imaginative and creative and, you know, interestingly subversive or, you know, just magical in the same ways that great movies are. And so I don't want to leave it that it's all this, you know, horrible, scary, dark stuff, because I don't think that's the case. The real point of the book was for people to understand it better, because we tend to get camps of the, I can do whatever I want, you know, I don't care if I'm killing people virtually, and the people, you know, who say it's the devil. And
basically just so much of the discussion is impossible to have with a whole huge segment of our population who are so ignorant about video games and what's happening, that we're not getting the kind of debate that we need in order to confront a lot of these questions. We're just getting the, well, it's pornographic violence, or it's, you know, just a way of numbing our children's brains, and et cetera. I mean, maybe it is those things to some people, but the point is that we can't really get to the bottom of what we can do with this technology, what we should be afraid of, what we should be encouraged by, until we start, as a society, understanding what they are better. And that's primarily the idea behind Smart Bomb, to give you a glimpse into what is going on in the various areas of this.
And we tried to do it in a very entertaining way, because I feel like we've been talking so dark. It's actually, the book is entirely narrative, and each chapter is a separate profile of a person that sort of represents a different aspect. And I really would like to say there are unexpected delights as well as horrors in the book.
All right. Well, I want to thank you both for spending time with us today.
Thank you so much for having us.
We've just been talking with Heather Chaplin and Aaron Ruby, co-authors of Smart Bomb, The Quest for Art, Entertainment, and Big Bucks in the Video Game Revolution.